Ethiopia is arguably the most ambitious and most closely watched attempt to make export-led manufacturing work at scale in Africa. And that's only one aspect of the country's wide-ranging set of reforms in recent years, which has seen the government embark on a range of macroeconomic policy changes across exchange rates, taxation, and more. Welcome to Ideas in Development, a VoxDev podcast on economic policy and research. I'm Oliver Hanney, the managing editor here at VoxDev.
And I'm Kartik Akhileshwaran, co-founder of Growth Teams. And in this mini-series, we're talking to policymakers about growth bottlenecks in low and middle-income countries and how growth policy actually gets implemented. Today, we're focusing on Ethiopia's economy, from exchange rates to the use of industrial parks to attract export-oriented manufacturing.
Today, we're joined by Mamo Meretu, who served as the 10th governor of the National Bank of Ethiopia, and before that was a senior economic advisor to the prime minister, where he was involved across a range of economic reforms. Mamo, welcome to Ideas in Development.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
So Mamo, I was wondering if you could start by telling us about your route into the policy world and government.
Thank you so much again for having me. My route to government is a bit unusual because I've been on, looking at, set of problems from different positions and seats, more or less from three places. I was first working for the World Bank Group, where I looked at trade, competitiveness, finance issues, mostly focusing on Eastern Southern Africa. And, a few years later, around 2018, following the change of government in Ethiopia, I was invited to join the Ethiopian government. That was a moment of hope, a moment of renewal for Ethiopia, and there was a big opportunity to have significant impact. So I joined the government as a senior policy advisor, where I helped design a set of macro and structural reform programs. So, and then eventually also I moved on and worked with different roles and capacity, including as the founding CEO of Ethiopian Investment Holdings, and then of course, as you said, the 10th Governor of the Central Bank of Ethiopia, where it fell on me to deliver and implement on a number of economic reform programs in Ethiopia, including the shift towards a market-based exchange rate regime, the modernization of the monetary policy regime, and also the opening up of the financial sector, and also sort of fostering the autonomy of the central bank. So I've been in three different places, as working for a development finance institution, working on policy design, and also later implementing and delivering these policies. And this gave me an opportunity to look at what works, what worked, and what didn't work, and really look at it from different vantage points. And also address this with some honesty. So that was a bit of background and my route to government.
If you could set the scene for us, when you entered government as an advisor, what position was the Ethiopian economy in? What were some of the underlying strengths of the economy? And what were the challenges that you faced?
Around 2018, when I joined the Ethiopian government, if you look at the headline macro figures, it was all positive. The economy was growing double digit, about 10%. There were significant public infrastructure projects happening in Ethiopia, including in energy. There was significant work in terms of implementing sort of at that time a bold industrial park development program. The state was involved in a number of infrastructure projects. And because of that, I think the growth of the economy was sustained. But, that was sort of the broad picture. But if you look at, the engine underneath, there were several problems that surfaced eventually. I think the biggest part is, you know, the Ethiopian growth model, for most part, was driven by public infrastructure investment-driven economic growth approach. And this was, for most part, supported by, you know, local financing. It's mostly debt-driven, and the government was able to capitalize on sort of captive financing from the domestic financial institutions. There was monetary financing of the budget by the central bank. There was a significant, you know, external financing coming, particularly from China. All of that led to significant growth in Ethiopia. But the problem was, although the economy was growing, all sorts of, you know, economy, particularly the financing, you know, source, have reached their limit almost at the same time. And that led to a significant macroeconomic imbalance in the Ethiopian economy. It led to a shortage of foreign currency. There was a big inflationary problem in Ethiopia, price stability issues, you know, because of significant financing, again, coming from domestic sources, particularly the Commercial Bank of Ethiopia, which is the largest financial institution in the country, and also external financing. That led to both financial sector instability risk and also debt sustainability risk. So there was significant macro imbalance manifested in FX shortage, manifested in inflation, manifested in debt sustainability issue, manifested in, you know, limited private sector participation that needed to be addressed. So that was the situation that we faced. And if I made, I may add one point, immediately after we start, you know, tackling it, all sorts of problem happened in Ethiopia. I mean, remember in 2020, COVID, and immediately after that, there was really tragic domestic conflict in Ethiopia. So that further aggravated the problem in the country, particularly the exchange rate premium reached almost 100%. And inflation was close to 30% for 3 years running. That, so all of this needed to be addressed. And that was the situation that we found ourselves in. And that's the situation that I entered into when I joined the government.
Great. Mama, we'll return to the macroeconomic issues that you mentioned. Oliver will come back to those. But before doing that, you know, we were keen to hear a bit more about the industrial park efforts that the government made. So industrial parks were one key tool that the government employed at that time and before, and it continues to do so. They were new to Ethiopia and potentially politically divisive. So how did this reform idea actually become government policy?
Yeah, I think that's a very, very important question. So the whole industrial park agenda were introduced in Ethiopia, I believe, around 2011, 2012, around that timeline. You know, at that time, of course, you know, I was not part of the Ethiopian government. I was working for the World Bank. But, you know, where I was in the World Bank, you know, my task also was to look at finance, competitiveness, industrialization issues. And I was able to observe the thinking and the development of the industrial park agenda in Ethiopia. So you see, you know, in Ethiopia, the industrial park agenda is not just an economic instrument. And for most, it was seen as sort of, you know, ideological pivot. And because of that, you know, at that time, members of the ruling political party felt a little uncomfortable with the idea. And then it was an issue that was very much contested. You know, the idea of an industrial park understood to mean, you know, geographically demarcated area where there will be a liberal economic policy that's separate from the rest of the country, and where you have an anchor for an investor, was a concept that was not familiar at that time, and there was significant debate internally. You know, from my observation, you know, three things happened, you know, during those discussions. The first thing is there was a serious effort, at least, you know, by policymakers at that time, to understand the development and evolution of industrial park in Asian countries. There's an attempt to study, you know, study that took almost 1 year to study the experience in China, the experience in Vietnam, Singapore, and Korea, South Korea, and even more importantly, countries that are less successful, particularly Nigeria. So that led to a document, a strategy document called Development of Industrial Parks and Industrialization in Ethiopia. And that was used as a consensus building tool to come up with a joint approach for the development of industrial park in Ethiopia. That's one thing that happened. Second thing that happened was, you know, and I think it was, I thought that was very smart, you know, the industrial park agenda was framed not so much as an ideological surrender of sorts, but rather as a tool to address practical problems. You know, the practical problems at that time was shortage of foreign currency, you know, low manufacturing base, low export performance. These were the issues, the problems that the Ethiopian economy faced at that time. And the industrial park was framed and presented as a tool to address those real binding constraints. And so for most people, you know, that was easy to digest and easy to understand and to lend support. But I think the third thing, and I think for me the most important thing, was there was a genuine attempt to develop the institutional infrastructure, the institutions, to not only develop the strategy, but also to implement the strategy. And that makes Ethiopia completely different from other countries that try to implement the same agenda. So we created the Ethiopian Investment Commission, essentially modeled against EDB, the Economic Development Board of Singapore, a new institution called IPDC, Ethiopian Industrial Park Development Corporation, was created again, modeled against JTC of Singapore. And the government also created the Ethiopian Investment Board that was chaired by the Prime Minister at that time, that provided overall strategic guidance to the development and implementation of industrial park in Ethiopia. And this is very, very important, because developing an industrial park agenda without the institutional machinery to implement it, that will not take you anywhere. And I think in Ethiopia case, that was exactly what happened. If I may just add one point on this, there is also a concerted effort to develop talent in those institutions in Ethiopia at that time. The people who led those institutions at that time were really, really talented people. People who put development at the center, people who, you know, were very open to learning, particularly reading, learning from the experience of EDB. And there was several attempts to learn from, you know, people who led EDB in Singapore, the cluster-based development approach, Philippe Yeo, you know, books like Hard Work of EDB. There were, you know, books that, you know, these people used to read. And the way they approach investment promotion and the way they approach cluster development was second to none. So I think that talent, that core, you know, people of technocrats who were supporting on the industrial park agenda, particularly at the Ethiopian Investment Commission, were instrumental in developing and implementing the industrial park agenda in Ethiopia.
You touched on a couple of points that I just want to ask a couple of follow-up questions on. So one is related to anchor investors. You mentioned that they were a key part of the industrial park strategy. What is the importance of targeting an anchor investor, or what was the importance, and how did the government go about actually doing that?
So this idea of, you know, targeting and attracting an anchor investor was implemented as part of the development of the Hausa Industrial Park. You know, the park itself, the Hausa Industrial Park itself, was completed in less than a year, the construction of the park itself. And from the construction to export of the first shirt to the US market, it took less than 2 years. And the idea of, identifying the anchor investor was done as part of this company called PVH, which is the second, at least at that time, I don't know if that's the case today, the second biggest apparel company behind brands like Tommy Hilfiger and, you know, Calvin Klein. You know, this company was targeted, you know, particularly because we knew at that time that if you have the anchor investors, all the supply chain players would come following the anchor investor. And that's precisely what happened in Ethiopia. The policy advisor at that time, the policy advisor to the then prime minister at that time, used to have this concept of queen bee, meaning if you target the main investors, all others will follow. In the case of PVH, you know, PVH came to House Industrial Park and all the suppliers, players in India, in Sri Lanka, in China, about, I believe about 12 to 40 of them followed and become tenants in the House Industrial Park. So that's what happened. If I may just add one point on this, I think the most important thing that was done during that time was efforts to attract quality investment and the way people handled that, particularly the folks who used to run the Ethiopian Investment Commission at that time. First, there was a personal attention, a personal effort, and a personal commitment to attract investment. And I remember at that time, the commissioner himself used to go to the airport at 3 o'clock in the morning to wait for and receive investors because, you know, it matters to really project that desire. Second thing is, you know, the government did a good job, at least in my view, to understand the needs of the investors. What do the investors wanted? They wanted infrastructure. They wanted, you know, clean source of energy. They wanted streamlined visa rules. They wanted sort of a shared approach toward this sustainability. And those are the core things that they wanted. And I remember at that time, you know, we did a case study on the investment attraction on House Industrial Parks. And, you know, most people talk about tax incentives, for example. For these investors, tax incentives was the icing on the cake, but it was never the reason. So they look at the broader picture. And I think Ethiopia was able to attract these investors, number one, because, you know, a clear national vision for manufacturing was presented to them. There was a focus on productivity and competitiveness. There was a focus on sustainability. There was a focus on improving the investment climate. And importantly, there were policymakers who were willing to break into the logjam whenever a problem surfaced. So it's not that problem didn't exist. Rather, it was the case that if the problem exists, then policymakers were willing to confront it and address it. So compared to other countries in the region, Ethiopia was successful, not because, you know, we were the cheapest, but because we were the most credible. And I think that, you know, that helped us, you know, manage to attract investment in Ethiopia during this time.
That's a nice segue to my last question on industrial parks, which is, what specific bottlenecks, you know, for example, local supplier firms or logistics or standards or skills emerged in the industrial parks? And how did the government unblock those?
Yeah, I think the whole industrial park agenda and broadly the manufacturing agenda was off to a good start. You know, I mean, there was real momentum behind it. I think at it is, sort of most successful stage, I think around, I believe 2020, 2021, the House Industrial Park alone, you know, created employment opportunity and others too, to around 100,000 people. So, you know, it was very important as a source of employment, but also export from industrial parks were increasing. But after that, you know, things happen. I mean, for us, a very unfortunate thing was the removal of the suspension of Ethiopia's AGOA beneficiary privilege. And that was the biggest problem. And that was, you know, a serious blow, you know, partly because for the textile sector, particularly competitiveness was based on Ethiopia's ability to export to the US market quota-free and tariff-free. So the moment that you take that away, it affects the competitiveness of the textile sector. And second thing is, you know, the conflict also had significant impact on Ethiopia's manufacturing export prospect and promise. And it's very sad because, you know, had it not been for the removal of the AGOA eligibility, I think Ethiopia's textile exports would have increased significantly. So it's not so much that we lost in terms of actual export revenue because of the cancellation, but more rather because we, the AGOA beneficiary privilege didn't continue and the Ethiopian textile sector didn't become what it could have been had it not been for that removal. So an occurrence of what could have been is, I think, you know, sort of a, you know, significant development loss that I personally still regret. Now, to your question, you know, what kind of setbacks did you face? I mean, I would say, you know, number one, I think broadly, the industry, if you look at the contribution of the industrial parks to overall GDP, it's less than 1%. If you look at countries like Vietnam, like, you know, China, it's often more than 20%. So I think, you know, despite the positive steps, I think there's so much that we can do in terms of expanding the Ethiopian industrial parks. But actual implementation of it faces a number of issues. The first issue that it comes to mind is the logistics challenge. You know, as you know, Ethiopia is a landlocked country, and for much of our import and export, we depend on the port of Djibouti. So almost 96% of our bilateral trade goes through Djibouti. And any problem with regard to custom clearance, you know, FX permit, dry port operation, port operation, in addition to the distance of it, so the logistic cost and time has significant impact on the competitiveness of the Ethiopian manufacturing sector. So I would say, you know, logistics cost, port operation, transit time, custom clearance process around it, and lack of adequate infrastructure, although we, you know, took steps in terms of building dry port operation, in terms of, you know, investing significantly in railway linking Addis Ababa to Djibouti, the logistic cost and time is a significant barrier to manufacturing competitiveness in Ethiopia. So we still have that issue with us to this day. So it's a binding constraint to doing business in Ethiopia. Second thing I would say is regarding our inability to foster domestic linkage between industrial parks and the domestic economy, particularly the SMEs. I mean, the reason why you attract investment is one, of course, for export, but even important, it is also for technology transfer, for the knowledge transfer. So if the industrial parks are not linked to the local economy, so domestic economy, then the impact will not be that significant. So again, on that, in that respect, there were significant limitations. And I said, third thing that comes to mind is the skills agenda. Of course, there was several steps. For example, in Ethiopia, we have what we call Textile Development Institute that provides training to workers. And there was also, I remember, a DFID supported, I don't know if they still call it a DFID, but there was a DFID supported sort of training for workers where they provide basic training to address absenteeism and turnover. All of that helped, but still the productivity gap between Ethiopia and Asia was significant. So I think on the skill agenda, there was a limitation. And finally, I think I would say, you know, there is more to be done in terms of the diversification agenda. And so I think the focus at that time was only on textile and apparel. But of course, you know, one could do more than that. So the IPDC leadership currently is doing some effort in that regard. You know, for example, there's an effort to diversify away from textile and apparel and move, for example, to new energy space, solars, new, you know, energy storage facilities and all of that. So I think these were the challenges that we faced, we still face, that we need to address. But broadly, I think supporting the manufacturing sector still remains to be an important agenda for Ethiopia.
And this leads us into the broader macroeconomic agenda, which has accompanied the export-led manufacturing push in Ethiopia. To start with, what macroeconomic policies do countries need to get right if they are to successfully pursue the avenues to growth that Ethiopia has been pursuing?
Having a strong macroeconomic foundation is always an important investment, whether to support export objectives or whether to support, manufacturing development. Prudent macroeconomic management, at least in my view, is a precondition. And I think the lesson here goes even beyond Ethiopia. And I think every country should invest in solid and prudent macroeconomic foundation. What do I mean by that? I think, first of all, it's very important to have an honest currency, meaning, it's important to have a market-determined exchange rate region. For me, the discussion about industrial policy and, competitive exchange rate regime is the same. If you support the manufacturing sector, if you start, developing an industrial park agenda, and yet, if your exchange rate regime is misaligned, if the exchange rate premium is like 80% or 100%, then that is a tax to every dollar your exporters export. Addressing the exchange rate regime is essentially creating a competitive manufacturing sector, avoiding distortions. And I think without that, it's very, very difficult to implement a successful export strategy and a successful manufacturing strategy, because a misaligned exchange rate regime is a tax to the exporter. It's a tax to the manufacturing sector. And if the export sector, the manufacturing sector, doesn't have the input to produce and export, then they will not be competitive. If you don't have a functioning exchange rate regime, they will not be able to have the foreign currency to import their inputs and then export. So for me, competitive exchange rate regime is an important precondition for a thriving manufacturing sector. So that's the first point that I would make. Second point I would make is it's also important to have low and stable inflation. I think the price stability agenda is also absolutely critical. It's very difficult for an exporter or a manufacturer to enter into a 5 years contract if inflation is hovering around 30%. If the price of input is not predictable, how could you predict the investment environment? So I think inflation, in addition to its impact on the low-income members of the population, it also has significant impact on the manufacturing sector. So I think that's also an important macro agenda. That's why, for me, a prudent monetary policy is always important, because the monetary authority should always make, price stability their core agenda and their core work anywhere in the world. The third thing I would say is, you need to have a functioning financial sector, functioning financial sector that provides finance to the manufacturing sector, that provides working capital loans to the manufacturing sector. I think without that, it's very difficult to plan long-term sustained economic growth. And finally, I would say, and something that's always underappreciated, is the predictability aspect of it. I think for most, businesses, for investors, if the business environment is not predictable, it's very difficult for them to plan. Take the case of the Hausa Industrial Park. The fact that AGOA is preferential and subject to the whim of a certain country has such a huge negative impact on manufacturing development in Ethiopia. So I think predictability in your trading environment, external trading environment, predictability in the domestic business environment is also an important area that we need to focus on. So I think, just to summarize, a strong macroeconomic foundation is important for sustained economic growth. It's very, very difficult to deviate from basic macroeconomic principles without facing consequences that will either reflected in acute shortage of foreign currency or in price stability objectives or in financial sector vulnerability. Eventually, something will have to give in. So I think investing in that would be absolutely critical.
In 2023, you became the 10th governor of the National Bank of Ethiopia. What specific policies did you pursue and how did they fit into the overall pursuit of economic growth and the macroeconomic fundamentals that you just discussed?
So I think when I moved to the central bank, you know, for me, you know, I spent quite a bit of time thinking about all of these issues and, you know, getting the macroeconomic reform in place was an important and urgent priority. And this is not in any way ideological. You know, our effort towards fostering a stable macroeconomic regime in Ethiopia was a response to the problem that we faced at that time. And when I moved to the central bank, you know, the situation was so acute that if you don't really address it, and if there is no course correction, if you don't face the problems and come up with a solution boldly and honestly, then that would lead to a significant collapse of the Ethiopian economy. There was significant shortage of foreign currency. So if you are, you know, a laser producer, for example, to be able to import accessory that's worth of $1,000, it will take you like 2 years to get a fix permit. I mean, with that kind of situation, what kind of economy are you managing? The central bank reserve was so depleted. You know, whenever there is fuel bill and fertilizer bill, it's always a struggle. Inflation was around, you know, 30%, and disassembly was such a significant problem in Ethiopia. These were real tangible macroeconomic challenges that we needed to address. Unfortunately for us, we had, you know, in Ethiopia, a domestic conflict that further led to the deterioration of the macroeconomic condition. So all of this need to be addressed. That is the context that I faced when I was when I became central bank governor. So what did we do? I think first thing that we did was we came up with our own strategy, the central bank strategy. That's way before, like a year and a half before the IMF program, the World Bank program, and where we said the central bank renewed focus will be on price stability. So we said we'll have three core objectives. Objective number one would be price stability. Objective number two related to that would be exchange rate stability and exchange rate reform. And objective number three would be financial sector stability. And then fourth objective has to do with the institution itself, the central bank itself. So we came up with a strategy, and that strategy informed our action for the 3 years that came after. So, you know, if I can summarize this time, I can summarize the reforms, but I think first thing that we did was we modernized Ethiopian monetary policy. We made price stability as a core objective of central bank. And for that, we have to actually change the enabling legislation of the central bank. So we significantly modernized the monetary policy. We moved to interest-based monetary policy. We created new institutions. We created new market instruments to tame inflation. So inflation was, as I told you, around 30%. Eventually, we managed to bring it to single digits. And then, of course, the second problem was, acute shortage of foreign currency. And again, you know, we moved to a market-based exchange rate reform that was in so many ways new because, you know, it reflects a change of a 5-decade exchange rate policy. We moved to wholesale new regime where, you know, FX will be determined by market forces. So that's also another important reform. We opened up the financial sector to foreign competition. we did significant work to foster financial inclusion. Even importantly, we revised the enabling legislation of the central bank, where the central bank will have instrument independence, instrument autonomy to really focus on its core task of price stability. We also provide a guardrail, a legal safeguard between the relationship between the central bank and the Minister of Finance, the Treasury, because one of the sources of the inflationary problem in Ethiopia at that time was the monetary financing of the budget. And there was no limit, you know, to what the central bank can lend to the Treasury. And that was leading to a significant inflationary pressure in the economy. So we have to rebalance things based on the problems that we encountered. And that's precisely what we did. And I'm more than happy to talk also about the results that we were able to achieve.
As a part of this big reform agenda, you spearheaded the introduction of a market-based exchange rate, which ended decades of a fixed rate. Given how significant this change was and how big a departure it was from recent decades, how did you build a coalition to get that done, and how did you bring the public with you?
The first thing is the exchange rate reform is one element of the broader macroeconomic reform program that we undertook in Ethiopia. There's a big component on monetary policy modernization, which for me is even more critical. As I told you, there were reform on the fiscal side of things in terms of debt sustainability and revenue-based fiscal consolidation. There was financial sector reform, but of course, the most prominent one is exchange rate reform. So on that point, first of all, even the content of the reform was not just a shift towards a market-based exchange rate regime. It's actually a wholesale reform of the exchange rate region. So one element of it is the price aspect of it, meaning moving to market-based exchange rate region. But in addition to that, we rationalized, streamlined, and consolidated, you know, regulations, foreign currency regulations that were in place for the past five decades. So there were more than 80-something regulations that were in place in Ethiopia. So it's very difficult for people to understand it. Even for me as a central bank governor, it's very difficult to understand what the applicable rule was, because the rules are so, they have been accumulating over, you know, decades and decades. So one of the significant reforms that we did was that we, you know, bring all these rules and then eliminated completely what we consider to be not necessary, rationalize them, simplify them, and consolidate them, and came up with one single regulation on FX. And we call that the Green Book. So for investors, for banks, for importers, if they want to understand Ethiopia's FX rule, all they have to do is just make reference to a single instrument. So that considerably simplified the Ethiopian FX region. We also gave license to new players. So for example, for the first time, we allowed FX bureaus to operate in Ethiopia. We give significant power back to the banks. So, I mean, the point is, it was a wholesale liberalization of the Ethiopian FX regime. So how did it happen? I think the first thing is, you know, we spent significant amount of time preparing for it. Even before we announced the reform, you know, starting from the day we came up with the National Bank strategy, we were preparing. So significant preparation. The second thing is, we made conscious effort in sequencing this reform. So I'll come back to this point. Sequencing reforms absolutely critical. So the exchange rate reform happened in July 2024, but the initial reform happened in August 2023, where we started tightening the monetary condition, meaning we imposed credit cap, we introduced a new central bank interest rate, we controlled money growth, all of that to create a context, a tight monetary policy context that will help us implement the exchange rate reform with no significant impact. So I think there was a sequencing element to that level. The third thing is, we try to coordinate with the fiscal authorities as well. You know, if you have a tight monetary policy, but not, you know, a tight fiscal policy, it will be very difficult. So there has to be coordination. And so there has to be some sort of independence, but at the same time, there has to be coordination. In our case, we had what we call a macroeconomic committee where the prime minister's economic advisors, the central bank governor, the minister of finance sits and discuss policy issues. And even when there is disagreement, the disagreement stays within that room. And we try to come up with, you know, sort of a joint approach to policy choices. And number four, we also came up with several mitigating measures to reduce the impact of the exchange rate reform on the Ethiopian economy. So, for example, we moved toward this increasing public salary for civil servants. We subsidized edible oil, fuel, and medicine. We also implemented the elimination of subsidy on fuel progressively, not all at once, to reduce impact. We made several steps to increase spending on social protection. So the mitigation measures are also very, very important. So all of that led to a successful implementation of the exchange rate regime. So I believe our economic reform program was well coordinated. It was well prepared because we spent quite a bit of time preparing for it. It was well sequenced. And then finally, it was well executed. A point that I want to emphasize is it's not just what we did. It's not the reform that we did. The most important aspect of it is how we did it, the methodology of it, the preparation, the sequencing, the execution, the coordination, and the support from the international community. The methodology aspect of it matters equally. So reform is not policy choices. Reform also includes how you do the reform. So it's not just the reform, but how you do the reform matters as much. Otherwise, you lose credibility.
So, Mama, moving to today, what do you see as the key next steps for Ethiopia to continue to progress on its path to become a middle-income economy?
I think in my view, you know, the macroeconomic reforms address conclusively sort of self-inflicted macroeconomic management mistakes that we made in the past. At the very least, you know, we've made substantial progress in terms of fostering and ensuring macroeconomic stability in Ethiopia. Just going back to, you know, the reforms and their impact. You know, if you look at, for example, the impact of the exchange rate reform, before the reform, Ethiopia's export was close to around $3 billion, you know, from $3 to $4 billion. This year, Ethiopia's export is expected to reach $10 billion in less than 2 years. If you just look at one commodity, the export of gold, before reform, it was around $200 million. After the reform, it reached $4 billion. So significant improvement in generating foreign exchange for the economy. And inflation was a big problem. You know, it was around 30%. Now it's single digit. You know, the reserve at the central bank increased by sixfold after the reform. So real tangible progress in fostering and ensuring macroeconomic stability in Ethiopia. So now we have the foundation. And for me, you know, I'm optimistic. I think it's very, very important that we focus on source of growth. We focus on the manufacturing sector. We focus on the agricultural sector. We drive economic growth now that we have a solid foundation. And we stay the course. And the most important point is it's important that we pursue prudent monetary policy and not find ourselves in a problem that we were able to address in the past. So if you stay on the course, if you still continue to have strong macroeconomic stability and you focus on source of growth, And I think the future will be promising. For me, you know, going forward, the real risk doesn't come from macroeconomic management, so long as we stay the course, but more on the political and external front. So, of course, for all of this, the foundation would be, you know, political stability. The foundation would be peace. The foundation would be regional stability. So long as I think, you know, all these other issues in terms of foreign policy, in terms of, you know, domestic political situation are conclusively addressed, I think the promise of the country is huge. I was reading this book, George Orwell, How Africa Won, recently. There's a line that he says, for Africa to work, Ethiopia will have to work. And I think that Ethiopia will succeed, provided that we stay the course, provided we address all the structural issues that I mentioned before.
So zooming back out, if you could distill what you've learned about the policy process across your roles, what's the most important piece of advice you'd give to governments looking to embark on an ambitious growth agenda?
So several lessons for me, particularly with the, you know, good fortune that I had of working in different roles, you know, as a role as sort of in development finance and also policy making and policy implementation. I would say the first thing I would say is it's very important to do a thorough diagnostics before you implement any policy. The real strategy in development policy and implementation is to focus reform energy on the things that don't really matter that much. So in Ethiopia's case, it was mainly, you know, FX shortage, it was financial sector stability, it was inflation. So it was not corporate tax issue, it was not labor standard. So I think really identifying, you know, the real constraint would be very important. And I think here, so this Hausmann-Rodrick growth diagnostic tool would absolutely be important. So that kind of mental exercise would be very, very helpful. It's also important that we should not be implementing what works in other countries. What you should be implementing is what is a binding constraint in your context. So there's a difference between that. You know, it might work best in other countries, but you, as a policymaker, your response should always be on the constraint that you face in that particular economy and address that boldly and conclusively. A related point here is, at least in my own experience, personal is always policy, meaning it's very important to assemble the right team and the right talent. As I talked about the Ethiopian Investment Commission, when you have the right team, people who put development at the center, people who are not really experts, but they have the openness to learn and to understand and to digest and synthesize information and act on it, then that makes development policy and implementation easy. Second point I would say is sequencing is half policy reform. So in our case, for example, we had mitigation measure before we announced the exchange rate reform. We spent quite a bit of time building internal consensus before we go public about our reform. We tightened the monetary condition a year before the exchange rate reform. And that was not delay. That was actually design, because we want to sequence it. If you sequence the right reform, but in a wrong order, then that would be, it will not be impactful. So I think, in my view, sequencing is really important. The third thing I would say is communication is an important and integral part of the reform process. So discussing internally with your team, coming up with policy notes, you know, bringing the public with you, explaining the reason for policy choices, treating the public as adults, using all sorts of communication tools would be an important lesson that we digest. And here, I just want to emphasize the role of research. Research would be useful. Research always informs, but research doesn't decide. So it's the role of policymakers to understand political economy, to understand context, and also to understand timing. So I think what policymakers need most of all is judgment. Judgment of what is the right policy at that particular time, in that particular context. So research, if it moves towards that, I think it will be particularly useful. So I think overall, you know, reform is very important, and reform also needs to be owned. If the reform is owned, then it outlives the person who initiated it or the government that initiated it. If reform is externally imposed, then it will die. So I think the key question for us is, you know, this growth discussion, the growth policy, to what extent would the policies that we initiated outlive particular institutions, outlive particular government, would be, you know, a question that remains to be seen.
Thanks so much, Mamo, for your time today and your incredibly insightful answers. This has been Ideas in Development. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us 5 stars or a thumbs up wherever you are listening or watching. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And our past episodes, as ever, can be found at voxdev.org.